This is a Triple J podcast.
Why do we close our eyes when we kiss? Where's the best heating position in the microwave? And do men really take longer to poo than women? It's the great debate. We get into all of this and more in this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's jump in. And we're going to start off in Mornington with Stuart, Dr. Stuart. What's your question?
My question is just regarding how you can test your blood alcohol content from your breath. It seems to me you'd have to get your blood to test it. I'm just wondering how that works.
And there's a bit of context here for you too, Stuart.
Yes,
tell us about that.
There is. Well, I'm a diabetic, so when I want to test my blood sugar, I can't just breathe on something. I have to prick my finger every time, which gets a bit boring after a while and a bit annoying. So I'm just wondering why they're different.
Okay, so Stuart, the good news is that in November 2021, we finally cured diabetes in a human. We tickled their DNA so that their DNA started making insulin again.
Ah.
It took 15 people, 20 years and $53 million US dollars. And it's a cheap investment and it's going to pay back billions. And so it will flow down the line. So keep your blood sugar level as good as you can until you can get permanently cured, because that means you'll have less residual disease of your heart and your eyes and all that sort of stuff. You'll come into the rest of your life healthy. Okay, getting that out of the way.
Dr. Carl, that's the best news I've heard for a long time. That's fantastic.
Read the New York Times. You'll get this for free.
Yes.
Gina Colata, K-O-L-A-T-A. Yes. So she's the editor. She wrote the article, and it was November 2021.
Mm.
And it was
a
look up
Thank
insulin.
You so much.
Okay, now to answer your question. Answer?
Yeah.
It's the size of the molecule. Alcohol is a ridiculously small alcohol. Molecule's got a molecular weight of about 46 or something. It's a very small alcohol. It's very small molecule. Very small molecule. It's volatile. It goes easily into the blood. Easily it crosses the membranes. Insulin will go into the blood with a bit of difficulty, and it will cross the membranes into your lungs with a lot of difficulty. It weighs 5,000 or 6,000, not 45. Theoretically, you could pick up insulin in human breath, but it's present in such diabolically small quantities that if you were able to pick it up, you'd have to have a very sensitive kit and you'd have to keep on calibrating it all the time. Whereas with the blood alcohol breath test, or with the breath test, the molecule's so small, it comes through in huge quantities and you don't need such a sensitive test.
Fantastic. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
thank you.
There will be some insulin there. And maybe we can spend 20 scientists 50 years and, you know, mate, if you put $1 into scientific research, you get $5 back after 10 years. There's no other investment that pays 500% in 10 years. But yet we don't do it in Australia.
That's sad. And the social benefits are even higher, aren't they?
Yes. And
the returns.
Thanks,
so
Stuart.
So stay strong, Stuart. Keep your blood alcohol levels as good as you – sorry, blood insulin levels and glucose as good as you can.
But hell, also
I will,
blood
mate.
Alcohol.
Yeah. Oh, no, they're quite different.
Yeah. We've got Alan from Caulfield here. Alan, I love this question. What do you want to know?
So I was making myself a coffee and I wanted to heat it up a bit better. So I popped it in the microwave and my question was, is it better to put it in the center of the microwave so it spins in a circle, or do you put it on the edge of the microwave so it doesn't lap inside, and why is it one better than the other?
Can I say, Alan, this is my issue. Usually I'll get a coffee right before the show starts, but then I don't drink it fast enough. So then about 9:40, I'm always running out, putting my coffee in the microwave, and I wonder the same thing. I usually veer it off to the left and then let it go on the outer edge. But what's the deal, Carl?
You are both doing the correct thing by letting it go through different areas. So what you can do with a microwave oven is disable the spin function.
Oh.
And the easiest way, there might be a button you can press, but you just simply take out the rotating platter. You know, there's a little gear in the middle, a little plastic gear, maybe 5 centimetres across, and then this big transparent glass platter. Take out the glass platter, and then maybe you have some little bits of wood or something to support. You have three bits of wood and put a plate on it. And so the plate doesn't rotate. And on the plate, put marshmallows.
Uh-huh.
right? And then cover it with plastic because, mate, the marshmallows just go everywhere. They stick like a... They're diabolical, right?
Yeah.
So you got a plate and you've got it so it cannot rotate. It's sitting on little supports. And you've covered it with plastic and just let it run for about a minute. And then take it out and look at it. And you'll see that certain bits are gloopy and certain are not.
Ah.
Then get a little flag, you know, like you have in an umbrella cocktail drink, your little flag thing, and you stick it in wherever it's gloopy and you measure the distance apart and it's about 10 centimetres. And with that knowledge, you can then work out the speed of light with marshmallows. You know, the velocity is wavelength times speed, blah, blah, blah. And you've got the wavelength, which is on the back of the microwave oven, about 2.5 gigahertz. And you've got the, sorry, that's a frequency. You've got the wavelength, which is about 10 centimetres. The point is that the microwave, left to its own devices, will heat up here and there and there and there at different places in the oven.
Mm.
So you've got two mechanisms to try to spread it around. Either you have the rotating platter, so it goes through everywhere, so it'll go through a high zone and a low zone, a high zone and a low zone, and or you have a metal fan to bounce the waves around so they go in all directions, but normally it's just the rotating platter. If there are some ants in a microwave oven, wash them. I mean, take them out. You don't want to hurt them.
Yeah.
They're God's creatures. But you'll see that they run to a point and they stay there.
Mm.
And they've gone to a place where there's not much radiation. Now, if you've got it in a dead middle, you might be lucky. Whereas just staying in the same spot in a microwave oven, and you might be lucky and you might have heaps of microwave radiation there, or you might have none. You might be in a place where the marshmallows have melted or where they have not. So if you put it on the outside, anywhere between the center and the outside, you've got a higher chance of it going through a hot spot, a cold spot, a hot spot, a cold spot. So the answer is put it closer to the outside so it's got more chances of running through a hot spot.
Oh, fantastic.
Thanks, Alan. I was going to say...
No worries.
I'm getting text saying, get yourself a double wall insulated mug so it stays warm for long enough. Microwaving a coffee is a sin. And you know what? Agree.
Oh.
I would never microwave a cup of tea. And when I see other people doing that,
I do.
But I do. I microwave a coffee.
Yeah, but it's real tea with tea leaves, and I've waited too long because I was having a shower and my wife
that's
made it for.
And then you have to, yeah.
And I don't want to make up a whole pot. It's not too bad.
Question, Carl. Yeah. Let's say a microwave didn't have that staggered kind of radiation.
Yeah.
What would happen? Let's say it's full hog.
Oh, okay. If the waves had a wavelength not of 10 centimetres, but say half a centimetre, it'd be even all the way through. Like the hot and cold spots would be half a centimetre apart and you wouldn't need to have the rotating thing happening. But you will notice if you put in a plate of, say, lasagna or something and then you take it out, every now and then you notice that parts of it, if you eat it straight out of the bowl, are warmer and some are not. And so you haven't got this perfect spreading of the radiation around. It's just a function of the fact that the wavelength is 10 centimetres and you're stuck with that.
Okay. We've got Graham in Toowoomba here. Dr. Graham, what's
your
question?
Good morning, doctors. Good morning, doctors. I've just got a question about water absorption in material, in cloth.
Mm.
I've noticed that when I, mop up a spill or something with one of those blue and white dishcloths, if it's really, really dry, it doesn't really want to absorb it. But if it's damp, it absorbs it much quicker.
Mm.
So what's going on there?
Ah, well, see, unfortunately, not fortunately, but in my family, everybody has been taught how to use a sponge.
Mm.
And most people have not been taught. So the way you use a sponge, is, and this relates to a tea towel and the other little wet cloths, what you do is you get the sponge and it's dead dry. And you put it under the water and the water just goes straight across the surface. And that's possibly because there was some fatty molecules in the last thing you wiped up and they're still there hating the water hydrophilic. So you just let the water run and eventually it'll begin to filter through and then you squeeze it a few times and then you've got the whole thing wet all the way through. So the next drop of water you put on it just goes straight, it kisses water. It goes straight into water and it spreads through the body of the sponge. So you never start off using a sponge dry. You always wet it first and then only when it's wet, you then squeeze out all the residual water and then you can use it to mop up the water and it will soak up the water. If you use it just dry, the fatty layer will tend to prevent the water coming in. Mm. And then, by the way, following on from the sponge thing, when you're finished using the sponge, just don't throw it in the sink. I've taught my kids this. What you do is you clean it. You clean the sponge. So you squeeze it, squeeze it, squeeze it as it's clean, and you put it away. In the same way with a towel, a towel is not used to remove dirty water off you. You use the water and soap to remove the dirt, and then the towel is only ever used to remove water. There's no a towel should be clean to the naked eye. And I learned this when I was working as a car mechanic, and they said, mate, nobody ever taught you how to wash your hands properly, did you? And I was using petrol and stuff, which I shouldn't have been using, because you get really greasy on your hands.
Does that answer your question, Graham?
Yes, I was hoping, I wasn't imagining things.
Mm. No, you did right, mate. So you are heading down the path of enlightenment with getting this, the wiping up cloth wet first. So then the next drop of water just gets absorbed straight against water.
My housemate and I have a bit of an ongoing argument about sponge use versus chucks.
Yeah.
I'm a sponge girl.
Mm-hmm.
She likes chucks. And I think if you use a cloth, it leaves more water residue on surfaces, whereas if you use a sponge, it's more absorbent.
I think I'm leaning towards you, but I'd have to actually try it and look at it.
Mm.
But I'm leaning towards following you.
Because, you know, you use a chucks and it leaves all this water residue, and then you've got to get in with a tea towel and dry it.
And do it again and again.
Just use a sponge.
Whereas with a sponge, you've got much more water absorption capability.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with a chucks, you just, or a very thin one, there's not a lot of volume or mass of water it can pick up. So you just got to keep it doing it over and over. And you don't want to throw them out straight away.
Don't get me started, Carl. I can go on about this forever. We've got Beck, or
Dr. Beck
in Sydney. What is your question? In fact, I mentioned this earlier, B. What's going on?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't want to generalize, but I'm pretty sure that men take a lot longer to poop than women do. And I know that this predates phones. And it's not just men who want to get away from their wives or whatever. This is, like, all men, as far as I know. So I want to know, like, why men take so long to poop when women can just get it done and get out of there.
There are various factors. I don't know the answer. One is the diet. So if you have a high fiber diet, things come out easily, more readily. By the way, look up on Wikipedia the Bristol Feces Scale, B-R-I-S-T-O-L scale, and it's a scale of 1 to 7, and at one end you got just sort of liquidy, rice squirty stuff, and at the other end you got rocks that you couldn't, you know, break with a hammer, and you want to be around 3 or 4 in the middle with brown floaty poos, and they should float and they should be well formed. So all I can think of is different diets of men and women, but I don't know if that's a factor. Maybe this is a case for actually doing the measurements. Like, how are you going to do the study, though, Dr. Bex?
Mm.
How are you going to have to get men to time themselves in and out? I'm saying we need data.
Tali in Melbourne. Tali, got a question about kissing.
I do. Hello. I'm just wondering why we close our eyes when we kiss.
Ah, and when did kissing begin? So the oldest written records we have are actually carvings by the Egyptians, 4,500 years old, showing people kissing. The oldest written records we have are about 3,500 years old, and they go back to one of the places on Earth where we invented writing, happened at different times, usually near rivers, and this was near the Indus River in India. And 3,500 years ago, they transcribed into written text their oral history, and they started writing things about kissing, and then ended up with the Kama Sutra. Have you ever read the Kama Sutra? It's that famous Indian love manual of how to kiss. And they say there's three ways to kiss. And there's the nominal, where you kiss another person and with the closed lips and they don't respond. What's that all about? They don't respond. And then there's the next one up where they do respond by moving their lips left and right. And then the third one where they respond by putting their tongue into it. And then kissing kind of spread via the Silk Road. You know, the Silk Road with the trade of spices from China all the way across to Spain. There was a way of getting knowledge and stuff across. And so it spread to Greeks, but it was the Romans who really got into kissing, and they had different names for different types of kisses. There are some societies where kissing does not happen. So there's the Mangi Island in the South Pacific, where the Europeans turned up in the 1700s. And on one hand, the locals certainly were good at making babies, but they just simply had no kissing at all. And then there are some societies where there's lip-to-lip contact. So in these societies, in Papua New Guinea, some parts there, the women, and also the women in the SAN society in, I think, Southwest Africa, what they'll do is make lip contact with their babies because they didn't have mushed up food. And suppose you're thinking, okay, time to wean the baby, 6 months old, and you're going to try and feed it some dinosaur meat, and blow me down, you're just going to get a dinosaur steak and shove it in its mouth because the poor baby doesn't have any teeth. So you mush it up in your mouth, and then with your mouth against their mouth, you put it in. And this is thought to be the origins of kissing. Now, those societies I just mentioned do not have kissing. They
really?
Did not until the Europeans turned up. And by the way, just as an aside, I did that with my kids.
Did you?
Well, imagine that we were living a couple of thousand years ago and you couldn't go to a shop and buy mushed food. And I thought I'd just try it with my son first and people said that was disgusting. But it's how we humans weaned babies for thousands of years, millions of years.
So do you know why evolutionary or like for – why did we start closing our eyes?
Okay, so getting into the kissing – so the thing about kissing is that the lips and the tongue are just richly endowed with nerve endings. And they're, for some reason, it's a pleasurable thing. And there is that whole concentrating your senses by closing your eyes so you can just feel the kiss. And I remember the first time I had a kiss, I thought, what is this magic that the universe has given? Why does it feel so good? I've never had anything like this. Even... I have heard that sometimes people practice kissing on mirrors and their hands or something. Have you heard about people doing that? I never did that.
Yeah, it's in, you know,
you've
a lot
heard
of
about it.
Yeah, if anyone's ever watched the movie Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging.
Well, what's it called? Anger?
Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging. She practices on her hand.
She practices kissing.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't do that. The first time I did, I just thought it was just out of this world. So are you going along with that hypothesis that the closing of the eyes as you concentrate and just feel with your lips and tongue all those delicious feelings coming through?
I think so. Tali, what about you?
Yes, I think that does explain it quite a lot.
I also think it's just awkward. Have you ever done, have you ever been having a pash and then you take a little sneak peek and they're also taking a sneak peek and you make eye contact for a second?
Well, then
it's
you
horrible.
Can vanish into each other's eyes. On the other hand, my son and his spouse, they're with our grandkid in Japan visiting various people and also seeing my martial arts teacher, Hisa, and he told me that he had never kissed his wife.
What?
He's a Japanese martial arts teacher. My age, he never kissed his wife. And in some parts of Asia and some religious countries, public kissing is just absolutely forbidden.
Okay.
Right? There are some societies where people just don't kiss.
Even in the privacy of their own home?
Well, the Mangi people of in the South Pacific didn't kiss. They thought, what is this putting the lips together thing? And they'd managed to make babies without that for however long, thousands of years. Mm. Oh, yeah, that would have been following Maui, so probably going back 50 or 60,000 years.
Well, now we know the origins of kissing. We've got John here. Dr. John, you've got a question about space.
Dr. Lucy, Dr. Carl, a long-time listener, first-time caller. Just wondering about terminal velocity in space and that if there is such thing as drag or can you just keep accelerating and going quicker and quicker?
Okay, in the atmosphere, we have what is chillingly called the terminal velocity. So if you imagine that a human jumps, don't do this experiment at home, folks, okay? If a human jumps, on one hand, you've got the suck of gravity, which is constant. But on the other hand, you've got the increasing speed, which then leads to increasing wind resistance. And it's not just simply a case of you double the speed, you double the wind resistance. No, it goes up. It's not linear. I think it's a cube law. So if you double the speed, the wind resistance goes up by 8. I forget the exact number. It might be cubed. It might be quartile. I don't know. But anyway, the point is, for a human, the terminal velocity is 200 kilometres an hour, roughly. For a cat, lighter and fluffier, it's about 100 kilometres an hour. And yes, it turns out that it is safer for a cat to fall from 32 stories than from 8 stories. This is called falling cats. Look it up in Great Moments in Science, ABC, Dr. Carl, falling cats. Getting back to space. Assume that there are no atoms. There are atoms, but just assume there are none. There is a terminal velocity, which is the speed of light. As you get faster and faster, according to Einstein, and Einstein was correct on this as he was on so many other things, as you get faster, your momentum increases, your mass increases, your length in the direction of travel decreases, and so your momentum is more than just mass times velocity. It goes way, way up. It's as though your mass is increasing. So at the speed of light, your mass is not just big or huge or the mass of the universe. It's infinite. So any object with mass cannot reach the speed of light. Because the mass would become infinite. So you can get to, we can do this with charged particles in the Large Hadron Collider underground on the borders of Switzerland and France, and we can get particles up to 99.999991% of the speed of light. And from memory, I think that the factor of slowing down 1 second for it is about 5 months for us. And so the mass increases by a similar ratio. So yes, there is a terminal velocity in space, which is the speed of light. Was that too long an answer there, Dr. John?
Or was that... No, that was perfect. I wanted that. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you, Dr. John.
Thanks, John. We've got Matt in Shepparton.
Dr.
Now,
Matt,
you are a boilermaker, and you were told something a few years ago. Talk us through it.
Yeah, I did. Hi, Dr. Carl, Dr. Lucy. When I was at TAFE, my teacher told me that argon, the gas argon, is the only thing that can replace the ozone layer. I was wondering if it was true, and if it is true, why don't we just pump the ozone layer full of argon?
Ah, now, for those people who don't know about welding and stuff, can you explain what a boilermaker is?
A boilermaker is someone that makes boilers.
So a boiler is something made of steel and you boil water in it and it's a certain size. How
yes.
big?
That I don't know.
Like a couple of metres across, a metre by a metre
yes,
by a metre?
Yeah, it can be a big tank, yep, a steam tank. They used to be riveted together, they're now welded together.
So as a boilermaker, what skills have you learnt? Welding?
Welding, forming of metal, learnt some of the molecular structure of steel and alloys, mathematics, science, a lot of stuff that I didn't know 20 years ago. And
wow.
I still learn stuff every week, every day.
Okay, so people, there's a trade for you. So ozone is a gas.
And it's a trade that's in very high demand right now and will be for a very long time.
Mm. Yes. We need less so get ready get with me's, more boilermakers.
Right. Yep. Okay, so the sun outside the Earth's atmosphere delivers about 1,470 watts of power per square meter. And the atmosphere filters that, so you've got about two-thirds or something by the time it gets down to the ground. One of the gases in the atmosphere is ozone. It's three atoms of oxygen stuck together. It exists in the ozone layer, which I forget the exact number. It's somewhere between 20 and 50 kilometres up, and it absorbs UVC. There's UVA just next to violet, and that causes cancer, 400 to 320 nanometres. You then go further into the ultraviolet to UVB, the way I remember it, UVB, B for burning, and that's from about 320 to 290 nanometres. And then you got UVC. It causes cancer like crazy. It's 290 nanometers to smaller numbers, and none of it gets through because of the ozone. Now, the ozone absorbs the ultraviolet light, so only about 5% of the stuff hitting the ground is UVA and UVB. It cannot be replaced by argon, which is a single atom. We had troubles with the gas called CFCs, a whole bunch of them, which were terrific in their job in refrigerant chemicals, but they had the accidental side effect of destroying some of the molecules in the ozone layer. And we humans got together with all of the companies in the world and we said, stop making this chemical. And all the companies in the world, a couple of dozen of them, said, no, it's impossible. We have to make it. And the countries of the world said, we're setting up the Montreal protocol, look it up in Wikipedia, we are banning them, make something else. And they said, okay. And they did. And so the ozone layer is coming back. But argon does not have the same UV absorption properties as ozone from my poor understanding of chemistry. I could be wrong, but I don't think it has.
No, that's all right.
By the way, argon is 1% of the atmosphere and is what you have in double glazing. Do you have double glazing in your house, Lucy? I know the answer. No.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so my daughter and my brother-in-law are in winter. And Australia, you know how there's a five-star scale for houses?
Mm.
Did you know that it goes up to 10? And that the a one-star rating on a house is a tent? Right? The average for Australia is 1.8.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my God.
It sucks. And you need double glazing. In my house the other morning, my wife and I got up, and outside it was 8.5, and inside the house was 18. Because we've got double glazing and good insulation. My daughter and my brother-in-law, they're all freezing. We don't have double glazing. When California brought in double glazing, we're talking winter here in Australia, when they brought in double glazing, after 1 year, double glazing was cheaper than single glazing because of the economies of scale, and everybody benefited because it wasn't so hot in summer, so cold in winter. Mm. How come we've got this sucky scale in Australia? It just sucks.
Mm. We've got Douglas in Hobart. Dr. Douglas.
Dr. Douglas, love you. Whoever you are.
Hey, how come?
Welcome. And by the way, before, have you ever seen the aurora down there in Hobart?
No, I seem to miss it just about every time it happens.
Oh.
Mate, you are in one of the best places in the entire known universe to catch the aurora. And the trouble is that when most people go out at night in Tasmania, they don't. And when they do, there's all streetlights around them. So it's just there in the sky for free, man.
I seem to be an early riser and an early going to bedder.
Okay, look, I'll stop picking on you, Dr. Douglas. Come on down. What's your comment or question, Matt?
I had a question around the mass and the weight of the Earth. Mm. So, like, I don't understand how people are coming up with a fairly good estimation on how much the Earth's mass is when nobody's really weighing everything on the Earth as such. Like, everything has a different density and has different amounts of other bits and pieces around the place. So, like, how do we know a rough estimate on that?
Okay, did you do chemistry at school?
No.
Okay, so there's a magic number called the Avogadro number. It appears all over the place. It's roughly, you write down the number 6, and then you write down 0 23 times. You write down 23 zeros. And by coincidence, besides being the number of molecules of water in 18 grams of water, or in 2 grams of hydrogen gas, number of molecules of hydrogen, it is also roughly equal to the number of stars in the visible universe, and by coincidence, roughly equal to the number of grains of sand on all the beaches on Earth, and by another coincidence, the weight of the Earth is an Avogadro number of 10 kilogram bricks. So what you do is you write down 6, you write down 23 zeros, you add another one for the 10 kilograms, and that's the weight of the Earth in kilograms. And how do you measure it? Cavendish did this experiment. So look up Cavendish in Wikipedia. So imagine that you're out in the middle of a very flat desert or the ocean, and it's dead flat, and you've got a little stand, and you've got a pendulum, you've got a string, and you've got a weight hanging off it. Now, take it to the bottom of Mount Everest. Mate, it's not going to hang vertically down and point towards the centre of the Earth. It's going to pull over to one side.
Mm.
And you can measure the weight of Mount Everest by that. And so by simple physics, by doing the Cavendish experiment, where you get a couple of lead balls and you just see how much they get attracted to each other. You can measure it with lead balls if you're very careful. From that, you can then work out via the physics of Newton's equations of gravity. You can measure the weight of the Earth. We have measured the weight of the Earth. Isn't that amazing?
Strange.
It is so strange. I mean, but
thank you.
Look, you do it through physics, and you do it with lead balls being attracted to each other, and then you plug the numbers into the equations, which we can't do unless we have got a beer and about 10 minutes.
That's it.
Trust me on this
hanging
one.
Hanging out.
Yeah, look, hanging out. Look, I'm coming doing some gigs in Science Week. Look, maybe I'll do it just for you, a thing on how to measure the weight of the Earth for Science Week. I'm writing it down. So come to my gigs in Science Week in Tasmania, in Hobart.
We've got Tom in Hamilton Island. Dr. Tom, what's your question?
G'day, doctors. So my question is, how do clouds stay in the sky if they're able to hold weight? Is that defying gravity?
Ah, the energy comes from the sun. Now, a typical cloud, you know, like a white fluffy cloud, not an incredibly wispy one, not a big thundery black one, but a light fluffy one, 1 cubic kilometre, 600 tonnes. So a kilometre by kilometre by kilometre, that's pretty big, 600 tonnes, which is the weight of the Airbus 380, the largest passenger plane on Earth. To get that off the ground, you've got to get it up to about 300 kilometres an hour. But if you're spreading it out not just over the small area of the wing, but an entire square kilometre, then all you have to do is heat up the ground a bit. So the sun dumps, on average, about 330 watts of power on each square metre of the planet, averaged out from pole to equator to pole, and day and night. So averaged out over the whole planet is about 300 watts. That heats up the ground. The ground gets warm. The air immediately above it gets warm, and it rises. And it's the updraft provided by the heat of the sun on the ground that then keeps the clouds up. Then it gets more complicated because you've got the Earth rotating and the Coriolis effect, but the main driver is the heat of the sun warming the ground, causing uplift. Does that
help? That's a lot to take in.
Ah, thank you.
So technically, is it effectively steam?
Steam, you have to get up to 100 degrees C, so it's heading down that pathway. But I'm going to leave you with a question now. This is your homework, right? You know that water boils at 100 degrees C?
Yep.
Okay. Now, suppose you've got a shallow puddle of water on some concrete, okay?
Yep.
Mate, it's gone by the end of the day, but at no stage, if you have a thermometer in it all day, does it reach 100 degrees? How does it happen? And I'll leave that for you as a question for next week.
All right.
Okay, we won't ring you up and pick on you as a very tricky answer, but just think about it and you know, let it mull around in your mind.
We've got Karen from Newey. Karen, what do you want to know?
Yes, I would like to know where our fat goes when we lose weight.
Karen, this was solved by Ruben Meerman. Not so much solved, but brought into public consciousness, who used to work here on ABC Radio and is now, I think, up in Bundy trying to teach primary school kids about atoms. You see, we don't teach kids about atoms because the French Piaget educationalist person said, you can't teach children abstract concepts. Well, you can. Anyway, he's teaching them. And he was the one who solved it. Okay, here's how it goes. It goes out the same way it came in, through your mouth. Now, here's some numbers. Do you have a pen and paper there, Karen?
Yes.
Okay, right, okay. 10 kilograms of fat. So to get rid of 10 kilograms of fat, you're going to have to bring in, through your mouth, 29 kilograms of oxygen. A chemical reaction will happen. Fat plus oxygen is going to give you two chemicals.
Yep.
You're going to get 28 kilograms of carbon dioxide and you're going to get 11 kilograms of water.
Wow.
And that's mostly overwhelmingly coming out through your mouth. Sorry, you were saying there, Karen?
Oh, no, I was just wondering, so if I hyperventilate, can I speed up the process of weight loss?
No, because you need to exercise via hyperventilating because you also need to increase the metabolic activity. So you will blow off a little bit of carbon dioxide, but after a while, your carbon dioxide level in your blood will have gone down and you won't be removing any more carbon dioxide. So you need to do the exercise. So move more and eat less. So 10 kilograms of fat plus 29 kilograms of oxygen, they then turn into 28 kilograms of carbon dioxide and 11 kilograms of water.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. And I want to know, have you seen the new Fast and the Furious movie? You might be wondering, how does it stack up scientifically? Dr. Carl did a deep dive on the movie.
Ignition!
Wait a second. What's this vehicle they're being launched from?
They've got a Pontiac strapped to a rocket.
You can watch that via Triple J's YouTube channel or get a quick taste via our Instagram TV. We'll have more for you next week. My name's Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Lou Hill.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.